Well, thank you very much for inviting me to give this talk. So, okay, so I'm on the phone today to tell you about the idea of promoting the Barberi-Mirsky parameter, which I'm going to call the BI parameter in this talk, you know, to a scalar field and its possible ties with cosmology. So, this talk is going to be about some of the physical and mathematical consequences of this. And this work that I did at Penn State right before I graduated with Victor Taveras and with Bai. And you can find more information about this in the archive. This paper's been accepted for publication in SRT. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. So we're on slide 2 now, the non-constancy of physical constants. Okay, so the general idea here was that, you know, in physics there are certain physical constants that determine the strength of couplings, the coupling of gravitational force with some matter fields, for instance, and they play critical roles in physical theories. In loop quantum gravity, as you all know, there's one parameter, that controls the eigenvalue of the area operator and other physical effects that are important. And it goes by the name of the Barberi-Mirsky parameter. And what we want to consider here is the possibility that this parameter is not a constant, it's actually a field that depends on space-time position. And we want to see what happens if we let this field be, if we let this parameter be a field, what modifications does it introduce to the field equation? And this idea of promoting a physical constant to a field is definitely not new. For instance, in Brans-Dickey theory, one way of thinking of Brans-Dickey theory is to imagine that essentially one is replacing the gravitational constant g to function g of t and x, where this function is determined by some, you know, scalar field that couples to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So we want to do something similar here, and we want to see what happens when one does this. So let's go to the next slide. So here's a brief roadmap of the talk. So in the first part of the talk, I'm going to describe the concept of modified Hall's gravity, which is nothing but, you know, promoting the BI parameter to a field. So we're going to discuss the action, the variation, the appearance of torsion in the field equations, and what equations of motion obtain. Then the second part of the talk is going to discuss, or is going to deal with cosmological solutions of this field equation. And we'll see that a stiff equation of state naturally arises in the solution. And in the last part, I'm going to, you know, discuss some preliminary speculation about the possibility of this BI scalar leading to inflationary solutions. So there's a couple of disclaimers in the bottom. Well, first, like, this is not really one of my traditional talks, which lacks a lot of mathematical formulae. In fact, this talk is heavy on the math. So I will, you know, only use a limited amount of Tweedle math. So most of the formulas you'll see here are going to be long, and I try to make them as accurate as possible, in spite of maybe confusing the presentation a little bit. But on top of that, I will assume that most people here in the audience is familiar with GR and the Holst action and exterior calculus and things like that. But if you are not, then please feel free to interrupt me and ask me questions. Definitely okay. So let's go to the next talk, slide. We're on slide 4. So the modified Holst action. So we're going to look at the action. S equals the integral of some Levi-Civita tensor contracted into tetrads and the curvature tensor F. But you'll see that, well, the first term is clearly the GR term, and the second term is the Holst term. And usually what is done is the gamma bar here is usually written as 1 over gamma. Gamma here is the BI scalar, but I'm going to work with gamma bar because, well, it's easier to work with. but the relationship is simple. But what it's usually done is this gamma bar is taken outside of the integral because it's a parameter. And then classically, the Holt action does not lead to corrections to the field equations because one can show that at the classical level it vanishes. Hello?
Just continue.
Okay. One can show that the correction of this term induces in the field equations is identically zero at the classical level. However, in this model, this gamma bar is a field. So now when one integrates by parts, one picks up the derivatives of this field that do not necessarily vanish. So one wants to see what this correction will do to the field equations. And one should say that to this action, one can add an additional potential term for the BI scalar, or one can add a kinetic term. I'm not going to present this in this talk, but we can definitely do that. Okay, so EI and EJ are the tetras, the wedge products are defined, and I think I've defined everything else here. So let's go to the next slide. So we're on slide 5, the field equations of motion. And the idea here is that we're going to vary the action presented in the previous slide with respect to the tetra, the spin connection, and the VI scalar separately. And if one wedges the tetrad with a variation of the action with respect to the tetrad, one essentially finds the equation I wrote first, which is something similar to the Riemann tensor, like curvature tensor, minus 1/2 and part of its trace. And that's equal to, you know, minus 1/2 gamma epsilon contracted into F. That's the first field equation. That's what would replace the Einstein equations here. The second equation arises when one varies the action with respect to the spin connection. What one finds in GR is that essentially it's only the first term presented there. It's the E times T wedge E. But then there are two additional terms. There's a 2 times gamma bar times T wedge E. T here is the torsion. Which is, this term is common in when one adds this Holt term. But if one promotes gamma to a field, one obtains another term proportional to the derivative of gamma that appears on the right-hand side. It's E wedge D gamma. This right-hand side is what's forcing the torsion tensor to be non-vanishing. And I'm defining the torsion tensor in the usual way. It's the derivative of the tetrad. And the third equation that one obtains when one varies the action with respect to the BI scalar is presented in C. It just tells you that the covariant derivative of the torsion has to vanish. Okay, so these are the three field equations. So we're going to work with equation B first, and we're going to solve that for the torsion. And we are going to then insert that solution into equation A and equation C to see what the equation of motion for the scalar field is and for the tetrad is. Did somebody have a question? No. Okay. So we are on, let's go to the next slide. We're on slide 6. We're going to solve for the torsion constraints. So here we used a projection operator that, as far as I know, was introduced by Rovelli and Perez that I present there in the upper right corner, PIJKL, the combination of delta functions and the Levi-Civita symbol. And one can rewrite equation B as this projection operator acting on the exterior derivatives of two tetrads. Now, if the right-hand side weren't there, then one would find essentially that the D of the EIEJ has to vanish, thus reducing to GR. But because of the right-hand side, one will now obtain a torsion tensor that is different from zero. One can hit equation B with the inverse of the P operator and solve for the torsion. And one essentially finds that torsion tensor depends on the first derivative of the immersive field contracted with the Levi-Civita tensor and with delta functions. With Kronecker deltas. obviously, in the limit as the immersive field is constant, distortion tensor vanishes and one recovers general relativity. Okay. So it's precisely because of this correction in the torsion that one obtains modifications to the field equation. So we're going to insert this torsion solution into the modified field equations I showed you in the previous slide. So let's go to slide 7. In slide 7, I have the field equations, and simplified by that I mean I just inserted the torsion solution and, you know, shuffled indices a little bit. So now I'm working with Greek indices, which are space-time indices, and one finds essentially the Einstein equations, but the T mu nu here is the T mu nu for a scalar field. It's essentially d mu gamma, d nu gamma, minus 1 half d mu nu, d gamma squared, except that one has a 1 over gamma bar squared plus 1 in front of the stress energy tensor. So this is similar to a scalar field with a non-traditional or non-canonical kinetic term. And observe there's no potential here for this scalar field because, well, I didn't include a potential at the level of the action in this talk. So one thus arrives at an important conclusion that if one promotes the BI parameter to a scalar field, one recovers exactly GR plus a scalar field stress energy tensor, this Holst fluid that I call here. So that's nice. If one does the same thing with the equation of motion for the scalar field, one obtains equation C, which I wrote at below slide 7, and essentially tells you that the BI field satisfies a nonlinear equation where box gamma equals some source term that depends on d gamma squared. Okay, so these are the equations of motion of your theory.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Before you go on, could you comment on the following thing, which seems a bit remarkable? The equation for the modification of the torsion in the derivative of gamma bar is parity odd. But when you plug back into the Einstein equations and your equation C, that goes away and you're left with something that looks parity even.
See what you mean. Well, if you recall, equation C depends on a contraction of the covariant derivative of the torsion field with a Levy Civita tensor. So to obtain equation C, I believe we've used the fact that we can convert the contraction of two Levy Civita tensors to a combination of delta functions, of Kronecker deltas. And that's what leads to the evenness in essence. So it's two odd equations that combine to lead to an even equation, I think.
Yeah, I'm not questioning the result, but it's remarkable that somehow the Einstein equations are protecting themselves against a violation of torsion, even though there's a lot of torsion odd stuff in the geometry.
Yes, I agree with that. In fact, recently I've been playing with the idea. I was going to comment on this later, playing with the idea of rewriting this essentially just as a forcing it to be just equal to the Einstein equations, the premises of a canonical scalar field, where you just have the canonical stress energy tensor and you have the canonical equations of motion for the scalar field. One can do that if one redefines the scalar field in a specific way. So if you write phi equals some function of gamma bar, then you can show that now the Einstein equations reduce to just the standard Einstein equations in the presence of a canonical scalar field. But this scalar field is now this function of this gamma bar, essentially. So it was very surprising, yes. I don't really have more insight than that.
By canonical scalar field, you mean just a zero Reshma scalar field, or what?
I mean just because. Okay, so in equation A, I have d mu nu equals kappa t mu nu, where t mu nu is almost a canonical scalar field, but you have this function of 1 over gamma bar squared plus 1.
Okay.
What I mean is that one can redefine come about the scalar field and say, okay, now I'm going to write a TMU for phi, where phi is some function of gamma bar, such that TMU just looks like d mu phi minus 1 half TMU d phi squared.
Right. I mean, you just have absorbing that into conformal. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. It's actually a trivial observation, but it's cute that it's essentially the same as the Anson equation in the presence of a massless Klein-Gordon field.
Yeah, massless Klein-Gordon. Exactly.
Okay. Are there any other questions? I'm not sure if I answered the previous question, but
no. I think what you said is exactly right. That this equation is quadratic, and so somehow the parity reversal term is just. But what Lee says is also true, that it is remarkable that this happened. I just wanted to make one small remark, that right in the beginning you said that that I am a collaborator, whereas all I did was to just suggest this idea and its cosmological application. And it's really Nico and Victor who had done all the work. And they are the only authors on the paper.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, we still benefited from the discussions we had. So let's continue. Let's go. We were on slide 7, I believe. So we're going to go to slide 8. So up to slide 7, we discussed part 1 of this talk, which was essentially deriving the equations of motion for the metric and for the scalar field, seeing what corrections to the field equations one obtains if one promotes the Barberi-Mirza parameter to a field. Now we're going to look at solutions. First of all, let's go back to slide 7 briefly. Let's just mention one thing from the get-go. I mean, all GR solutions are solutions, all metrics are solutions in GR are solutions to modified Hall's gravity in the limit as the Barberi-Mirza parameter becomes a constant. I think that's obvious. But in the modified Hall's gravity, you essentially expand the space of solutions, because now you can have other solutions where the Barberi-Mirza parameter is not a constant. But you have essentially GR in the presence of a scalar field. So now we want to look at cosmological solutions in slide 8. So let's go to that slide. And what we're going to do first is we're going to choose a flat FRW background. We're going to neglect any back reaction of gamma bar on the metric. And we're going to assume that the Barberi-Mirza parameter satisfies the same symmetries as the background. So we're going to assume the Barberi-Mirza parameter is a function of time only. It's homogeneous and isotropic. So here the FRW metric I consider was something like minus dt squared plus a squared and a flat metric, right? So the t that appears here is that time coordinate. The a's that appear there are the scale factor. The dot stands for time derivative. Yes. So the Friedman equations are presented in the first line. You have one of them is a double dot divided by a plus 2 times the Hall parameter square equals 0. That's completely unmodified in terms of Thomas modified gravity. But then you have another equation that is modified. You have minus 3 a double dot over a equals something that depends on the time derivative of the BI scalar squared, in fact. That's right. And then that comes from the modified field equations, so the field equations for the metric. But you also have an equation of motion for the scalar field that's presented in C. So it's the second equation that has a green oval. And that tells you that the BI field has to satisfy something like a wave equation of the left-hand side sourced by a gamma dot squared term. And H here is the Hubble parameter, so A dot over A. So we have a couple system of equations, and we want to solve this. And it turns out that C has a solution. We can just go ahead and solve that with a little bit of inspiration. So let's go to the next slide, where I present the solution. And it turns out, you can essentially solve for gamma bar by itself. But the first step would be to, integrate once to obtain an equation for gamma bar dot squared over gamma bar squared plus 1. that is obtained after integrate once. And then you can integrate that equation one more time to obtain gamma bars as a sinh of some integration constant squared divided by a cubed. Okay, so L naught is an integration constant that arises after you integrate once, the equation C I presented in the previous slide. Yes, so, and there's yet another integration constant that arises due to the argument of the hyperbolic sine function. So a few remarks. Near the singularity, as A goes to zero, gamma bar seems to tend to infinity, which means that the BI parameter, which is 1 over gamma bar, is actually tending to zero. I thought that, well, we both, well, all of us, when we were talking about this, thought that there was an intriguing result. Could this be related to some sort of asymptotic freedom where, you know, the BI parameter becomes essentially free near the singularity? We don't know. Much more work needs to go into this sort of analysis to see if anything like this is even possible or correct. But yet, it's an intriguing result I wanted to mention in the talk. So now that we know what the solution for gamma bar is, we can now use that into the modified Friedman equations to solve for the scale factor. So this is also a remarkable fact that you can solve for gamma bar without knowing what A is, in essence. Well, more or less remarkable, I guess. But now that we know what gamma bar is, we go to slide 10, where I have inserted, we inserted gamma bar into the modified Friedman equations and then solve the modified Friedman equations. And one essentially gets that A scales as some constant times t to the 1/3. T naught is another integration constant. So one finds essentially a stiff equation of state. An equation of state, you know, if you were to make an analogy with a perfect fluid, with a pressureless perfect fluid, this would be an equation of state with W equal 1. And now that we know what A of T is, we can go back to the equation we had in the previous slide for gamma bar and do the integration and calculate the sinh, and we would find that gamma bar goes as T to the 2/3 plus T to the minus 2/3. So not only does the BI parameter tend to zero as T goes to zero, but it to T naught, but it also goes to zero at infinity in this model, which is clearly perhaps controversial, because one would imagine that the BI parameter should tend to its black hole value, at least near a black hole. But we are not finding that here. If we were to introduce a potential for this BI parameter, then it's very possible, and this potential depended on, you know, some characteristic mass of the black hole that you're studying, then it's possible that you could drive this BI parameter to its black hole value near black holes. But that's not a possibility we have investigated. We just presented the solutions up here. So let me stop here for a second, because that concludes part two of the talk, which were cosmological solutions, or solution. Are there any questions? Okay. So let's go to the next. Sorry? Okay. So let's go to the next slide. So now we are on part three of the talk, which I labeled in my slides as pure speculation. So we're going to talk about inflating loop quantum gravity. Before we actually can talk about inflation and other speculations, I wanted to address a few questions and some problems that one immediately sees when one does this scalarization of the BI parameter. The first one I already mentioned, namely that the BI scalar is not tending to the black hole thermodynamic value. So it's possible to add a potential. It's possible to add a kinetic term for the BI scalar, perhaps. So there are ways that one could drive this BI field to its black hole value in some region of space if one so desired. The other interesting issue is that the BI scalar tends to zero near singularity, which seems to suggest if one were to just treat this BI scalar as one treats the Barberian Mercier parameter in loop quantum gravity, would mean that there's some sort of continuous area spectra in the quantum regime near the singularity. Of course, this is also very preliminary, because now that BI parameter is a field, one has to redo the quantization analysis, and one has to, you know, make sure that this gamma that appears now in the modified field equations still represents the minimum eigenvalue of the spectral operator or something like that. So one has to redo the quantization. It's very premature to make any statements about the area spectra. But it's an interesting suggestion. And the third problem is the one relating to inflation. If you have a stiff equation of state, you will never get inflation. So can you have inflation with a more general scalar field of some type, with a potential, or with higher curvature terms or something like that? Well, I mean, how can you possibly get inflation? And now, before we go to the next slide, let me just make a few comments. So when you have inflation, essentially you are modeling a scalar field in an FRW background with some specific potential, and this potential has to be very, very peculiar in a sense. It has to satisfy a certain set of conditions called the slow roll conditions, which essentially guarantee that the potential of the scalar field is very, very flat. Now, what is this field is one of the main questions that one would like to answer. And there's sort of two mainstream ideas. One is that this field is some sort of, it should come from particle physics. It's some sort of fundamental scalar field, some sort of axion or some sort of light degree of freedom of that kind. Something that you would put on the right-hand side of the Einstein equations in the stress energy tensor. Another idea is that this field should be somehow related to the fundamental gravitational theory that describes the universe. So if you think about string theory, there is a gazillion scalar fields that one can add, and these scalar fields go by the name of moduli, and they are related to the distances measured along extra dimensions. So for instance, the distance between a brain and an anti-brain or things like that. Or a distance. So there are many, many, many of these different scalar degrees of freedom. Yet it seems incredibly difficult to be able to come up with an inflationary model coming from string theory that would lead to such a flat potential that satisfies the slow roll conditions if the inflaton is to be understood as one of these moduli. On the other hand, in loop quantum gravity, as far as I know, there are no scalar fields or no intrinsic scalar fields like the moduli fields of string theory. The previous studies of inflation in loop quantum gravity, at least the ones I found in the literature, deal with what happens if one adds an inflaton field to the right-hand side of the field equations, in essence, and one studies the field equations at one loop or higher quantum corrections within the loop quantum framework. But what we have here is a way to generate a scalar field from the geometry itself, which it's suggestive, if anything. So having said that, can we actually make this work is one of the questions. So let's go to the next slide, slide 12. So what I want to do is I want to compare the stress energy tensor I presented earlier to that of a commoving perfect fluid. So the three velocity is going to be set to zero. And, the equation of state P equals omega rho or W rho is such that W has to satisfy the equation I wrote down there. So something that looks like gamma dot squared minus d gamma squared divided by gamma dot squared plus d gamma squared. And then if one expands this equation for gamma dot is much less than d gamma, one obtains the right-hand side, 1 minus 2 d gamma squared over gamma dot squared. I forgot an a squared in that equation. Sorry about that. But it's not really all that important. The point is that one obtains essentially 1 for W minus a small correction. But this equation that I wrote down here is valid only if the spatial gradients are very small. If, on the other hand, the spatial gradients are dominant, and I, you know, leave the idea behind that the BI scalar has to be isotropic and homogeneous, then it's possible to obtain an equation of state where omega is actually identically equal to minus 1. For instance, just set gamma dot to 0. But does it make sense to make the BI scalar spatially varying? Well, that's an interesting question, but we are not going to address it further in this talk. The point is that you can produce an equation of state with omega equal to minus 1 if one allows the BI scalar to not satisfy the same symmetries as the background metric. Another way to
can
get...
I,
yes.
Oh, can I ask a question? I mean, it sounds bizarre to have, you know, to go down that line to allow gamma to vary spatially, because if you think about the philosophy of inflation, you're inflating the universe to create homogeneity at late time. Whereas if you have, you know, spatial variation at early time, that you will never get homogeneity later. So that's why usually we don't take, you know, spatial variation of gamma, because inflation will not smooth out the field.
Could you say that again? Yeah, I couldn't hear you very well.
The reason of usually doing, I mean, one of the reasons of doing inflation is to get homogeneous space-time at late time, right?
Yes.
And the way it's achieved is that you take... The problem is that if you have an initial field which is varying very on short scale, right, and then you inflate this guy, it will still be varying on short scale at late time, and you will not get homogeneity. So, you know, you could get omega equal minus 1, but the conclusion
right.
would be that the
right.
late time universe will be extremely inhomogeneous.
That's right. It might violate other assumptions that the inflationary paradigm is supposed to, you know, solve. I completely agree. I'm just presenting possibilities here, because
okay.
when we discussed this in the paper, we just assumed gamma bar was equal to a function of time only, and, you know, neglected any other possibilities essentially until the last section of the paper. And that led us to the conclusion that you got a stiff equation of state. All I'm trying to point out here is that if one relaxes some of those assumptions, it's not true anymore. But yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm not saying that this is a viable way to do it. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah, but good remark. Another possible way to do it would be to go through along the lines of k-inflation. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next slide, slide 13. So, an interesting thing we found, not too surprising on inside, is that if we reinsert all these solutions back into the action, then we essentially get the action for a scalar field. So you get R, which is the Einstein-Hilbert term, you know, plus a term that depends on gamma bar times d gamma d gamma. If you just had a scalar field, you would just have d gamma d gamma. But here you have a function of the scalar field multiplying the d gamma square term. So this is why it's sometimes referred to as a non-canonical kinetic term, because you have this function of gamma bar there. And this is similar to what's done in the model of k-inflation, or k-flation, sometimes referred to. And the idea is you're not going to... But it has two ingredients, right? One of them is that... Well, the main idea is that you want to drive inflation without a potential. That's why K is in front of the word. So the idea is that it's kinetic inflation. You're driving inflation purely from kinetic terms. And how do you achieve that? You need two ingredients. One is you need non-canonical non-canonical kinetic piece, that is a term like the gamma bar square, but that's multiplied by some function of the field itself. But that's not sufficient. You also need another term that's quartic in the derivatives, a term that I don't have here. So you need something like d gamma bar to the fourth times another function of the scalar field. And then depending on what these functions are and their relative signs and whatnot, one can do an inflationary study and determine whether inflationary or exponentially expanding solutions are allowed or not. The point is that if in the model as presented here, this is clearly not sufficient to have k-inflation because you only have quadratic derivatives of the scalar field. But if somehow, if for some reason you needed to add a higher curvature terms to the action, like a Gauss-Bonnet-like term or a Chern-Simons term, something like that, then because of the appearance of d gamma in the torsion condition, then you would obtain d gamma to the 4 power terms arising due to the higher curvature terms that you would have added to the action. So, in short, what that means is that if you UV complete modified Hall's gravity, and by that all I mean is if you add higher curvature terms to your action, then indeed k-inflation can be mapped to this scenario, and it's possible to have inflationary solutions even for space-independent BI scalars. So let's go to the next slide, and this is a very silly example that we looked at. We essentially said, well, you know, let's just take the R term of the Einstein-Hilbert action, and that R term, it, because of torsion, leads to the second term in on slide 14, the 3/2 gamma bar, blah blah blah. But let's also add to the action an R squared term. So that R squared term essentially is going to produce a term that goes as the squared of the second term, which is like gamma dot to the 4th divided by gamma bar squared plus 1 squared. And there's a minus sign for technical reasons there that one can calculate. And this is essentially the form that one would obtain in a k-inflationary model. The arbitrary functions here would be like 3/2 times 1 over gamma bar squared plus 1, and the other arbitrary function would be minus 9/4 times 1 over gamma bar squared plus 1 squared. One would then have to do a k-inflationary study to determine whether this actually leads to inflationary solutions that are acceptable within observational constraints, right? But this is not sufficient because I slightly cheated here. If I were to take R plus 3/2, the 3/2 term quantity squared, I would not only produce a term like the minus 9/4 that I presented here, but I would also produce a cross term, a term that looks like R times R, the Einstein-Hilbert R, times this gamma dot squared term. So you see, not only do you produce quadratic derivatives, but you are also modifying your quadratic derivatives. And these quadratic derivatives are actually coupling. They are not functions of the field only, but they are actually functions of the geometry too. Furthermore, I also cheated twice here because it's also not sufficient just to say, oh, I'm just going to add an R squared term to my action and see what happens. I mean, you have to have a good reason for adding higher curvature terms to your action. And in fact, if one wants to add a string theoretical motivated higher curvature term, one would add a Gauss-Bonnet term, for instance. It's not just an R squared term. It's an R squared plus a Ricci tensor squared plus a Riemann tensor squared terms. It's three terms. And those three terms need to be taken together. They need to be studied together to see what corrections they would add to the action. That hasn't been done yet. But the point is that by adding these higher curvature terms, then one naturally obtains quadratic derivatives that could be mapped to the k-inflationary paradigm. So let's just conclude with that. So let's that concludes part three of the talk essentially, and let's go to slide 15 now, and I'll present my conclusions. There will be some time for questions. So the main point here is that we have, you know, studied the idea of making the Barbieri-Mercier parameter a scalar field and seeing what this does to the field equations, what corrections it induces. And we found that the modified theory becomes equivalent to GR in the presence of a massless scalar field with a non-trivial kinetic energy term. So that was result one. That was essentially part one of this talk. Interesting possibilities from this is that one can think of of this method of this scalarization of the BIA parameter as a natural relaxation mechanism for to start with some arbitrary, you know, initial conditions for the BI parameter that naturally flow toward the black hole thermodynamic value given some potential, for example. One then would have to ask, well, why do you add that potential? But at least it would be slightly more generic than just adding yet another constant of nature. That's just an idea. Another idea that, you know, arose from this study of modified Hall's gravity was the possibility that you could fit somehow inflationary solutions with an intrinsic geometrical scalar field from low quantum gravity. But as we saw, having an isotropic and homogeneous BI field without higher curvature terms does not lead to inflationary solutions, but instead leads to just a matter-dominated universe. If one allows for more generic scalar fields, something that varies with space, then this could be allowed, but as was mentioned in this talk, it's possible that that might not be a viable model for other reasons. Similarly, you can also add R-squared terms to the action, and again, you can obtain corrections that are quartic in the derivatives of the scalar field, which would thus also allow for inflationary solutions. But as I said a few seconds ago, you would have to be careful to check what other corrections to the dynamical solution for the scale factor, for instance, these corrections introduce to make sure that they don't spoil other cosmological predictions of inflation in general. I guess I'll conclude here and I'll take any questions you might have. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gianluca from Penn State.
Oh, hi.
When perturbing a cosmological and a free Robinson worker background with inhomogeneous perturbations, K-essence K-inflationary models typically may and actually do have two problems. One is a violation of causality, and the other is the development of caustics. Did you check whether this model is affected by these two problems? In particular, the second one might spoil the assumption that you can get an effective equation of state of inflationary type.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I did not mean to say that K-inflation is a solution to the inflationary paradigm. In fact, I don't think anybody knows of a solution to the inflationary paradigm. So nobody has looked at this, to answer your question directly. One of the problems with it would be that you would have to come up with higher curvature terms that you need to add to the action. If you don't do this, then your K-inflationary model is just not going to lead to inflationary solutions, period, and it makes no sense to look at the homogeneous perturbations because you just won't have an exponential expansion at all. Now, if you add higher curvature terms, then this expansion is possible, but you have to show that first. That hasn't been done yet. Then you also have to justify why you are adding those higher curvature terms. And then third, I would look at the homogeneous perturbations about that cosmology. I agree with you, but it hasn't been looked at yet.
Yes, the problem with the higher curvature terms is that they do have classical or semi-classical instabilities.
Well,
if you want, so it's
it depends. The Gauss Bonnet term doesn't necessarily introduce Gauss states, right? And Gauss states are not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, on a Freeman Robinson working background, it does introduce Gauss. Not on Minkowski, but on arbitrary curved backgrounds, you can have Gauss even for a Gauss Bonnet term.
Right. So it depends on the background you're perturbing about, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. I was reading the other day a paper, somebody arguing that a condensate of ghosts could actually lead to an explanation to the dark energy problem. So you're right. Adding higher curvature terms might not necessarily be a good thing, but The jury's still out on that.
Don't believe everything you read about ghosts.
Okay.
This is Abhay. So, I mean, my initial motivation for looking at something like this was really to see what happens if we let this parameter be actually a function, as is quite often the case, right? I mean, we start with some parameters, like in Banziki theory, as you said. But now that it is actually, it is true that if you, I think the transformation is something like a pinch of phi equal to gamma bar. If with that transformation, actually, the so if I use this,
yeah.
If you use the field, if you use the field phi, then this theory is completely equivalent to Einstein with a massless scalar field.
Absolutely.
My motivation was that, well, I mean, simplest cosmological models where I've been using a massless scalar field, and maybe there is a geometrical origin of this massless scalar field, which is supposed to give us a notion of time and so on. It's really going a little bit away from inflation in a way. The second thing is, but nonetheless, I think it makes the, it opens up all kinds of directions up here.
Yeah.
For example, one might want to redo the analysis that Tomas Pawlowski and Param Singh and I did about the bounces and so on with this gamma, I mean, interpreting the scalar field phi to be really coming from this Barberi-Mirzi parameter. So Barberi-Mirzi parameter is actually, you know, it's allowed to be a field in the cosmology varying in time. And then the question is, what happens? And in particular, one interesting question is the question about superinflation. So classically, of course, you don't have some, you know, inflation without a potential or something like that with a scalar field. But we know that superinflation just after the bounce is a very robust feature of loop quantum cosmology. And one of the problem has been that the superinflation doesn't last long enough to just be a substitute for ordinary inflation. So that is to say, you know, it doesn't have enough e-folding and so on.
Right.
And one of the interesting questions for me is, if in fact one actually does read, it's not very hard actually, but rethinks the calculation through that Tomas, Param and I did with gamma, the Barberi-Mirzi parameter being really a field now, and interpreting the scalar field phi, that is to the cinch inverse of gamma bar, as the scalar field we used in our analysis, then what happens to this superinflationary phase? I mean, it could be that that is actually extended. Maybe it is actually killed. I don't know. But I think it's a sort of interesting idea to pursue in general. And my point is, I think, rather than jumping immediately into whether it gives us inflation, k-inflation, etc., I would like to just understand first conceptually, a little bit playing around the conceptual consequences of making this jump, and then worry about whether, you know, it tends to the black hole value. I mean, your point was that gamma goes to zero at late time, but that late time is really a time equal to infinity.
Yeah.
So it could be actually decreasing, and maybe there is some, if you really put everything in together, one could perhaps justify that the reason why the value is so small, I mean, it's, you know, less than one, about a quarter, could be that this is a phase of the universe. I mean, you might have to put in cosmological constants, et cetera, in it. So I think one shouldn't take any one of the scenarios too literally, but I think it gives you a new playing ground to try out lots of ideas, especially because it seems to fit in rather naturally in the scalar field-driven FRW cosmologies that we have studied in great detail.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It opens a plethora of possibilities and new research directions that haven't been pursued yet.
Any other questions?
This is Lee again. If I can come back to the issue of parity, this is a kind of open-ended question, but it's remarkable that the Einstein equations protect themselves against breaking of parity, and one you know, one somehow would have thought that by doing something like making the inertia parameter a field, giving it dynamics, since the torsion is then, you then get a dynamical torsion, which is parity odd, that there would be, you know, some modification of the Einstein equations that was parity odd. Is there any hope by going to higher order, or, you know, or something? And the reason why I push this is that there is a window observationally to see parity odd effects in the tension mode in inflation. If inflation is correct, then one expects quantum fluctuations of the spin 2 field to be observable, and it turns out that there's a lot of sensitivity to parity odd effects if there were parity odd effects there in the tensor mode.
Yeah, I agree. Well, two points here, I guess. The observational windows exist, but the observational the actual observation is incredibly difficult because the B field that Lee is referring to are going to be contaminated by foregrounds that need to be removed. So, especially.
That's not true. There's sensitivity in the interference between the B and the temperature, and there's a paper coming out shortly which even has the required sensitivity.
Oh, I see.
I forget the name of the experiment, but I saw a draft of a paper.
Okay. Well, I was referring to a few talks that were given here in this past week, where pretty much everyone was arguing that, especially for a large K number, it would be very, I mean, it's still possible, but it depends on what the overall magnitude of the B fields are. And that's sort of still open. But anyway, observations are observations, and they do it great. As to your other question about parity violation, if you had a Chern-Simons term, you're going to have parity violation for sure. So if you just add an RR dual term to your action, I mean, okay, so I haven't done the calculation, but I have done a similar calculation in a different context with Stefan Alexander, and so the appearance of parity violation is unavoidable. But you have to add an RR dual term.
No, but I think even within the current scenario, in some sense, at the zeroth order level of understanding, supposing, in fact, gamma was actually a constant, then it is also still true that if I just looked at the whole section, so to say, by itself, then there seems to be a parity violating term there, but that is actually... But the field Einstein's equations, however, are unaffected, and therefore there is no parity violation directly. However, if I had a spinner field which is coupled, then I think, and if one repeats this scenario...
Oh, yes. If you add, a Dirac term. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a spinner field. Then I think there will be kind of a feedback of the torsion and the dynamical gamma, the emergent feedback of that back, there could be a back effect on the gravitational case. And then I think this idea that Lee is saying parity violation in gravity might actually come about in this model if one also does coupling to spinner fields. And Victor and Simone Mercuri are looking at that.
Yeah, I agree. I talked to Victor about this sometime yesterday or so. And yeah, if you couple this to the Dirac fermions, then your torsional constraint is going to be modified. So you're going to have a new term on the right hand side. And even if you just go back to the papers of Perez and Rovelli and many other papers that followed, I mean, they showed that even in the standard Hall's gravity, where the BI parameter is a parameter, it's not a field, then you do produce torsion, but you have to be careful about what sort of fermion term you add to your action. If I remember, there was some debate there at some point that got resolved later on. But now, if you let the BI parameter be a field, now there's going to be corrections on top of that might back react on the metric and lead to refill. Yeah, fluctuations. Yeah, I don't see why that's not possible.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.